Tuesday, the 5th of November, 2024. Focused upon three standards at the moment. Time on my hands, once in a while, and Laura. Have an idea to use them as an entry point into memory via recordings of my attempts to play and sing them. Not very well. Recordings of my piano from outside the house with sounds of the suburb and natural events, trees, birds, etc. Detailed discussion, extempore, of the voice leading, harmonic language, and word setting. Really only internalised ponderings. A record of me trying to improve my renditions and in the process revealing details of how the songs attain their effect. The tone needs to be apologetic, never didactic. Friday, the 8th of November, 2024. Relative to the previous notes, the three standards have condensed to only one, namely Laura. This song has preoccupied me for decades. Now I'm deep in an analysis of the score. Music, David Raxon. Lyrics, Johnny Mercer. So far, I've completed a diatonic version of the chord progressions and key areas. Then I want to slowly divulge how the chromatic texture might have evolved. Could this be a model or analogue for the accretion of life experience on an initially innocent soul? Wednesday, the 13th of November, 2024. Struggling with Laura. It came to mind that I might want to use the Sinatra rendition, only to find that he sang it a minor third lower than the Raxon score I've been using. When I proceeded to copy out a transposed version, the difference in tessitura made nonsense of the voice leading in the short score and muddied the entire spectrum. So I've ditched the Sinatra and returned to the Raxon original. But only after a half-hearted search of the internet for some other version that was in the same key as my score. Anyway, I think the Sinatra and the entire idea of comparing various renditions was a red herring. Now I can concentrate entirely upon the analysis and where that might lead, if anywhere. The story is that the lyrics by Johnny Mercer were written after the music was composed and the film was released. He wrote the lyrics without having seen the film, and apparently in a weekend. All sorts of stories about his inspiration being triggered by a Dear John letter from his wife. The title of the song, Laura, was insisted upon by Preminger, as the song would be associated with the film and thus sell better. All of the circumstances around the composing of the music seem to be prosaic and pragmatic, seasoned professionals coming up with the goods. That's what makes the exceptional effectiveness of the song and the lyrics so chillingly ordinary. So it's not just the music, but also the lyrics that cry out for close examination. Have to find a way that's not didactic. A forensic analysis that inadvertently serves as an analogue for life. Thursday. No. Say again. Sunday, the 24th of November, 2024. We're at Jack's hut again. It's 10 minutes to 10 in the evening. I've just been out intending to make some recordings of low tide murmur in the bay, but instead found myself standing and looking at Port Levy and the bay and a very still evening. And as I had my recorder with me, I just played some of the files I'd recently made and listened to them. And of course, they were all to do with Laura, the David Raxon song with Johnny Mercer's lyrics that I've been fascinated by for the last three decades. and I'm having my latest bout with. And listen to the song and watch the bay and realise that in the distance, a long way away over the hill and down at the house, out on the veranda were Michael and Steve and Margot, I think, having a smoke and talking about life. Their voices weren't discernible in any sort of, you know, I couldn't understand what they were saying, but you could hear them. There they are there. Floating, very much like the laugh that floats on a summer night. And I keep on wondering, what am I doing with this thing? Is it the end of my creative life? And I'm just too afraid to put down my tools and say enough's enough. Or is there something new waiting for me in this song? Some new old wisdom. I'm halfway through my 82nd year and I'm finding all sorts of strange places. But the song won't let me go. And the feeling that I have, which isn't a new feeling, the feeling of searching down into the experience and the sensation, looking for the idea. But it feels as though I'm searching for the information I need to make sense of the stage of my life. And it's in the song. There are my wonderful friends talking. Gaining comfort from one another. This song is a miracle. And it can tell me everything I need to know to sustain me in this place.
Monday, the 18th of November, 2024. All sorts of difficulties with Laura. At the moment, revolving around the necessity to make a transposition of the Raxin score, down a minor third, to fit with the Sinatra. But I'm having all sorts of difficulties playing the transposed version, probably because I've memorised the original. Keep on trying to invent reasons as to why the Sinatra should go. But I know it's just because I don't like the transposition. It also sounds muddy. The voices lose their melodic virility, and this, along with my tentativeness, makes for a bad result. Also, should I use excerpts from the soundtrack of the film? Are images needed, hands-on piano, keyboard, etc.? I think not, but everything seems to go down the plug hole the more I tussle. Even keeping clear my objectives of struggle, oh dear. Sunday, the 24th of November, 2024. Attack Laura on as many fronts as possible. Don't consider how they might be connected. Some starting points. 1. Lyrics. Images used. How are they reflected in the music? Word painting. 2. Musical structure. Bar-by-bar analysis, leading to tonal architecture, diatonic armature, key centres, and chromatic overlay. Voice leading, very important. 3. Circumstances of composition.
Preminger, etc. Lyrics post-music, story of how the title was retained. 4. Various renderings on the web, Sinatra or not, singing the notes or singing the meaning of the notes. Other factors. Baseline first, leading to diatonic implications. The texture becomes more and more elliptical from bottom to top. Unresolved voice leading. Expectations from the diatonic version elided. The upper added tones, 7th, 9th, 11th, 13th, forming an ambiguous layer. Demonstrate this by removing the supporting armature. Film soundtrack. Need to listen to this even although it was made with no regard for the lyrics of the song. I may be able to construct useful comparisons. Thursday, the 5th of December, 2024. Have decided to jump straight in with Laura and record a casual investigation. No script, just the piano and a microphone. However, there could be a place for a spatialized rendition of certain chords so that the listener finds themselves inside the chord or phrase. I think the great majority of this work will consist of untouched piano sounds with and without commentary. Try speaking the lyrics with the top line removed from the accompaniment. Move from this to an examination of the tonal structure relative to the meaning of the lyrics, especially the way the end of phrase cadences match the rhyme scheme. You know the feeling of something half remembered, of something that never happened, yet you recall it well. You know the feeling of recognizing someone that you've never met, as far as you can tell. Well. Laura is the face in the misty light. Footsteps that you hear down the hall. The laugh that floats on a summer night that you can never quite recall. And you see Laura on the train that's passing through. Those eyes, how familiar they seem. She gave your very first kiss to you. That was Laura. But she's only a dream. Laura's lyrics, the rhyme scheme. You know the feeling of something half remembered, of something that never happened, yet you recall it well. You know the feeling of recognizing someone that you'd never met, as far as you can tell. Well, Laura is the face in the misty light. Footsteps that you hear down the hall. The laugh that floats on a summer night that you can never quite recall. And you see Laura on the train that is passing through. Those eyes, how familiar they seem. She gave your very first kiss to you. That was Laura. But she's only a dream. Well, tell, well. Light, hall, night, recall. Through, seem, you. Dream. Sunday the 8th of December, 2024. Yesterday I decided to change the studio back into angry mode because I realised I was well into the making of Living with Laura and I needed to be in the sweet spot rather than moving into the centre of the enclosure and back again every time I made an adjustment. That was yesterday. I'd already begun constructing the Master Pro Tools session, but thought I was ages away from completion. It's now 4 p.m. the following day, and I have a first draft. Unbelievably quick. But maybe not that quick. I've been making materials for months now, lots of piano work in the house, and a great deal of making notes about the idea. The song has branded itself on my memory and keeps on repeating in my head day and night, especially night. This has obviously built a huge head of steam, so that when I was sitting in the sweet spot, ready to begin, I was actually, in fact, almost finished. I'll leave it now for a few days to cool off, and then re-listen to pick up any anomalies or obvious mistakes from too close a connection. I'm pleased, though, because I know this work springs from genuine concerns, and I've avoided applying ready-made solutions. Sunday the 15th of December 2024. Just played Colleen, the latest version of Living with Laura. I think it's finished. Certainly another of the enveloping works. I'll leave it for a while before I bounce.
Okay, so I'm just going to jump in here. I suppose I could have scripted this and done it all sort of formally, but I'm just interested in finding out for myself what Mr. Rexon has done. So I'm going to take it in phrases, beginning with the musical. So, we look at the bottom line. It's a diatonic as well, and actually the key
to think about this song that's really the most fascinating is the title, which according to my research was simply Laura because the film was called Laura. And the idea was to attach the song to the film, which was a big hit, and make a lot of money.
So the key signature is zilch. So apparently it's either A minor or C major, but it obviously begins first line, you know the feeling, in G major. So we've got a five, one.
The word begins out of nothing. There's no consonants, no syllables. It wells up from inside the throat into a vowel, law, and ends with a breath, ah, Laura. There couldn't be a more ghostly name than Laura. She comes out of nothing and dissipates into thin air. One big vowel. Soft, diaphanous, like a cloud or a mirage. Tuesday the 17th of December 2024, still tweaking Living with Laura, but the perennial doubt about the use of candid field recordings keeps niggling. When I use the material, it feels right and natural as a positive contributor to the work. But when I try to analyse how it functions, I can't come up with anything like a satisfactory response. I get confused and panic-stricken. So I'm going, for the umpteenth time, to attempt to tease out just what's going on. I shall endeavour to hold the sounds at arm's length, trying to examine my reactions as though they were those of someone else. The piece opens with a field recording, situating the listener in a particular location inhabited by a lone narrator whose tone is candid, informal, unscripted, rather hesitant, with one or two prolonged pauses which reinforce the sense that he's commenting on the fly. Quite soon, the topic of Laura, the song, casually emerges with the information that it's the revival of a long-time obsession. Included is a reference to the distant voices of friends, reminding the protagonist of, quote, the laugh that floats on a summer night, unquote, a line from the lyrics of the song. Of course, this makes no sense to the listener at this point in the work. It functions as a precursor to the examination of the lyrics that occurs later. At this point, the protagonist's ponderings broaden and deepen into concerns of a more personal nature, in particular the role of the song in his current imaginative life. He locates it as a possible source of new wisdom, of understandings that might help him adjust to the circumstances of his ageing. Now the reduced chordal progressions of the song enter, very faintly at first, combining the sound of a piano with those of the field recording. So the listener is faced with two seemingly unrelated categories of material. And here's my response to this situation. I accept the piano music without hesitation. I hardly even notice it. It seems to function as a musical accompaniment to the narration. Questions such as, how can a piano be playing in this location? Is there a piano in the house where the friends are talking? What's the piano got to do with the field recording? None of this occurs to me. The presence of the chords, especially with their long caesuras, allowing the narration to remain in the foreground, coinciding with the more confessional content of the commentary, underscores the personal, emotional implications of what's being said. Towards the end of the narration, the motive for analysing the song is articulated, binding what's to come with the personal quest of the narrator, and ipso facto with the scenario of the recording, so that at every subsequent appearance of the field recording, the role of personal revelation is implied. The bay is the site where the protagonist, the same person who's investigating the song, for stated personal reasons, in order to discover useful understandings, ponders his life, which at this point in time is inundated by an obsession with the song. He establishes the relationship of the two realities, Jack's hut and the inside location where the piano resides and where the analysis will be undertaken, so that they belong together. The music is making extant the emotional repercussions of what's being said, causing the field recording to step back and become more than simply a recorded reality. It takes on a metaphorical role as the music generates its absolute musical implications. So the role of the piano, as I've commented many times previously, is similar to that of a cinematic music track, the visual aspect of which is taken by the field recording. Note, the topics covered by the narrator are crucial. 1. The effect of listening in real time to a recording of an environment of which you are a part. The idea that this experience encourages one to stand apart from one's own life in a way that's impossible when one is completely immersed. 2. Randomness and the persuasiveness of authenticity, the privilege of being alive. And 3. Counting waves. The fact that they continue after he stops counting but will eventually come to an end. These are philosophical musings. They deal with the paradox of human mortality in the face of the seeming continuity of the non-sentient world. So as he attempts to get to the bottom of how the song works, a task which founders upon its own data, the same individual ponders life from the dispassionate sound world of a recorded reality. No matter how you look at it, everything in the work becomes dreamlike, or maybe nightmarish. So the unifying factor between the field recording and the analysis of the song is the protagonist himself and his constant pondering search for meaning. I think this is what allows me to accept the paradoxes inherent in the work, but will this apply to any other listener?
And if we look at the notes that are in that first chord, that's coming up from the left hand. So those first three notes are a dominant seventh, secondary dominant. A lighted leading note should go to here.
Imagine if it was called Kate, or Penelope, or Rosemary, words with more than one syllable. No, it just happened to be called Laura.
So we've got Miss Delight. So he's insisting that these notes are essential because he's leaping to them.
A funny phenomenon, isn't it? I'm listening to the environment in real time through my headphones. So the environment is being recorded. Two stereo mics and mixed down to stereo, and I hear it as a separate phenomenon. As soon as I take the phones off or stop the recording, I enter into it in a way that I can't perceive at arm's length. I enter back into it again. So when I make a recording like this, I'm actually recording my life, my series of incidents, progressing along the set number that I've got left. And I'm listening to them. Of course, the microphones are amplifying the background. Here we go. That flapping noise is some towels hanging on the clothesline about, I don't know, 6 meters away from me.
So the first three notes are just the secondary dominant seventh. Then we have on top. And those notes obviously don't belong to the diatonic chord. We don't have. We have. No, those upper notes.
So within the body of the song itself, we have a number of really specific scenarios. We've got the face in the misty light. We've got the footsteps going down the hall. We've got the laugh on the summer night. We've got the train that's passing through. It's not stopping, it's just thundering through the station. Then we've got the eyes. Then we've got the kiss.
There's the leading note going to... But we've got another leading note on the left hand. They can't both go to there. That's parallelism, and we lose the voice. So the middle leading note goes down.
Concrete ideas, but then they're all negated by the last line, but she's only a dream.
But what Mr. Rexon does, instead of trying to disguise that leap down of a leading note, he puts in a passing note. And he puts in a chromatic passing note. So this progression I play the inner voices.
So everything has its feet cut out from under it.
So that gives you parallelism. Goes to an upper auxiliary and back down again, and eventually gets to the note it should be going to, which is this one. It should go.
Laura.
Never quite, and on quite we've got the appoggiatura. Re- call diatonic notes. These are chromatic appoggiaturas or auxiliaries. But the chord, that's the last crotchet beat of the third bar, still has a root of C.
Tuesday, the 7th of January 2025. Colin and I saw the film Touch this morning, a visual treat with a complex plot resonant with memory. Hit quite a few tender spots for me. At one point during the film, I had a premonition of how it will feel when I close the door of the studio for the last time and sense a lifetime of obsessive work and its results slide off into the past. Something I did once. It held a great deal of relief, but also unfathomable sadness. I realise I savour more and more this excruciating nostalgia. It fills my breast simultaneously with exhilaration and despair. Reading through old notes, the 2004 ICMC keynote address, and lo and behold, Laura, with some long-forgotten comments about the song, which led to me reworking the programme for Living with Laura. This made me think again about how the work has altered over the last couple of years since the Candid Field recordings became an essential part of the finished product, and how this was facilitated by the immersive aspect of the instrument. The out-there, proscenium arch nature of the stereo works being replaced by the in-here conspiratorial ambience of the latter works, from listener to witness. I see that this has been paralleled by a more thoughtful and intricate program booklet, concerned with providing enough information to contextualise the work itself. So the booklet becomes much more integrated into the entire package, becoming part of the work rather than a simple adornment. I realise that the dichotomies often present between various categories of material require some sort of support to assist the witness. Wednesday, the 8th of January 2025. One more thought regarding Living with Laura. A way of attending that I've touched upon before, namely with peripheral awareness. The idea of not focusing upon a central point, or rather to take into account that part of the thing under observation that hovers out of focus on the periphery. I intuit that this is a necessary method of attending when listening to Living with Laura. The seemingly unrelated categories of material, the Port Levy monologue and the song, imply a sort of out-of-focus relationship, or perhaps their combination provokes an unsettled feeling leading to a dilemma of meaning in the listener. The question remains, is there a complex but fruitful result from this juxtaposition, or is it in fact meaningless? Friday, the 10th of January 2025. Note to myself regarding Living with Laura. Have backed up, made CDs, put the MP3 on the website, the lot. Only then do I realise I've made a monumental blunder. And now have to dump everything and go back to the master session to put things right. This has, of course, happened before, but this time I left the master session unbounced for an eternity in order to avoid what eventually occurred anyway. Detail. My blunder was to become too involved in my analysis of the song, to keep on listening to and wondering about the content, or more accurately, continuing to be fixated upon my ability to reveal Mr. Axon's technique. I fell into a classic egocentric mind fuck. Last night, I realised that the content of the so-called forensic analysis was not important. Most of it would be double dutch to a lay listener anyway. What was necessary was for the analysis materials to be blown away, literally, by the wind from Port Levy. This is what I've now engineered. I had to ditch retaining the prosaic subject of the analysis. Just let it be swallowed up by the wind. Stop savouring my analytical achievement. So now the listener is unconcerned by their lack of knowledge of music theory. They simply categorise the analysis by its intention rather than its content. So the wind sounds pointed to in the field recording erase the analysis when it insists upon its theoretical reduction. Note, this solution also resolves the former problem of far too much continuous analysis.
So the melody insists on leaping to a note which isn't the root third or fifth of the chord.
I sort of got to the point where if I turn the field recorder on, no matter where I am, without even thinking or listening to anything beforehand, I'll find information that's useful to me. Phenomenologically speaking, I mean. Business of randomness. And yet when things are left to their own devices, left just to function in a dispassionate context, they always have this infuriating authenticity and persuasiveness.
Wonderful in a melody.
Here we go again. God, I love that wind sound. Come on. A couple of paralyzed ducks just went flying up the valley. What an extraordinary sensation it is to be alive.
So what gives this feeling of obscure ambiguity, which is present, especially when you leave out the melody. Something disturbing about it. And the only reason it can happen is because the basis is diatonic. If that wasn't there, then there'd be nothing for the chromaticism to work against. That's the wonderful quality of a clear
morning. I got up quite early. I went down to the bay. There was no wind. I found myself in a little spot and I began counting waves, as I want to do sometimes. And I counted 81, one for each year of my life. And then I stopped. But of course the waves didn't today. They kept on coming. They will stop eventually. Oh, listen. Listen. Everything will stop eventually. I guess you're a real lucky bastard if you've been part of it all. Something's happening to the weather.
wind is getting stronger.
Footsteps that you hear down the hall. There's an implied triplet. Footsteps that you hear down the... is the face in the... floats on the...
At the end of every one of those lines is a perfect cadence.
I'm going to go and get some pegs, and I'm going to hang up the towel that's fallen on the ground.
Thursday, the 16th of January, 2025. Making fine adjustments to living with Laura. Very, very fine. Changes in position and level, which are totally dependent upon the bespoke nature of the instrument. Getting that particular low-frequency interference between A1 and 2, 3 and 4 that makes the space shudder softly. And again, I bemoan the fact that when the instrument is gone, so will all of these minute details that make the work really effective. I think about how many individuals will experience the work inside the instrument, and no matter how I rationalise things, I am sad